You're listening to The Dollop. This is a bi-weekly American history podcast. Each week, I read a story from American history to my friend.
Gareth Reynolds, who has no idea what the topic is going to be about.
Unless you look at the iPad.
You had...
Like a cheater.
You have been using an iPad this whole time!
God, you want a little hit of dude?
I'll do one bump.
People say this is funny.
Not Gary, Gareth.
Dave, okay.
Someone or something is tickling people.
Is it for fun?
And this is not going to become the tickling podcast.
Okay.
You are Queen Fakey of Made Up Town.
All hail Queen Shit of Liesville.
A bunch of religious virgins go to mingle.
And do what?
Pray.
Hi, Gary.
No.
Nicely done, my friend.
No. No.
We're brought to you in part by Policy Genius. Look, if someone relies on you for financial support, whether it's a child or an aging parent or even a business partner, you need life insurance. Life insurance, it gives you peace of mind. So if something happens to you, your loved ones, they're going to have a financial cushion to pay for things like rent, mortgage, loans, education, just everything, daily expenses. And usually life insurance gets more expensive as you age. So it start a policy soon rather than, you know, waiting on it. So look, head over to policygenius.com and answer a few questions about yourself. And in just a few minutes, you can work out how much life insurance coverage you need. And then you compare personalized quotes to find your best price. You could save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. And they work for you. So Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. So you can trust them to offer unbiased help and advocate for you at every step until you're covered. They don't add on extra fees. They don't sell your info to third parties. So head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. We are brought to you in part by Zen Business. Look, a lot of people right now, the great resignation is on. They're like, they're out of their jobs. They're like, I don't want to do this anymore. I want more control over my life. I want a better life. I don't want a boss man telling me what to do. And so a lot of people are starting their own business. Zen Business is very, very helpful. They got an all-in-one platform. It guides you as a new entrepreneur through all the stuff you have to go through to get it going, an LLC or whatever you're going to set up. Got a super easy pricing structure. Starts as low as $49. And then look, they're not going to hit you with a bunch of hidden fees. It's all very straightforward. What they say is what it is. They have a very fast and simple business formation for LLC and other business structures. Worry-free compliance and annual filings, so you can stay in good standing with the state. You can secure an employee ID number so you can open a bank account, hire employees, protect your person, all that stuff. I wish I had had Zen Business when I started my business. It would have freed up all that time I spent on paperwork and all that stuff, so I could have just focused on the business. So look, Zen Business has helped hundreds of thousands of people get their business off the ground by guiding them every step of the way and making it easier to launch a successful business. Get started today for as low as $49 at zenbusiness.com/dollop. That's zenbusiness.com/dollop. 1946!
Nice.
Theodore Lewis was born in Memphis, Tennessee. Oh, I don't think his last name was Lewis here. That seems to be a mistake I made.
Okay.
Theodore was born in Memphis, Tennessee. His parents were migrant workers. After the family moved to Waco, Texas, shouldn't it be Waco?
Well, considering recent history, yes.
His dad just up and bailed on the family.
Okay.
A few months later, Theodore's mom took off also.
I don't think that's okay. I think that's kind of like a race. The one person's like, later, you're like, oh, no, it's like when you hand somebody like an empty beer just so they hold it and you don't have to throw it out.
Right.
It's like, it's not your problem
that's
anymore.
Yours.
You got to go throw it out.
That's your thing. So that left James, who's a toddler, and his two sisters, who were 7 and 9, in a transient motel outside of Joplin, Missouri.
Literally, the elder is 9?
Yeah. So the mom left two girls, 7 and 9, and a toddler in a transient hotel in Joplin, Missouri, of all.
Oh, this is going to work out fine.
Social workers took the kids and immediately split them up. That's what you did at that time. Break up the family. Break up the family.
Yep.
The Big Brothers agency were placed in charge of Theodore. And then they found him a new home with Floyd and Charlotte Lewis.
Okay.
Because Theodore's life had already been a nightmare, they decided the best thing to do would be to rename him James Lewis.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's not a cat.
I would even feel weird doing it to an animal. Like, animals know their fucking names.
You can
figure it out.
Cats, you can.
But a fucking human?
Jose's changed his name since the election of
Is
Trump.
Is that true?
Yeah, he's now Jose. And he's doing an accent.
He's still coming for him. I already reported him.
No!
So, James...
It's going to take a couple guys to carry him.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's going to be heavy. It's going to be hard. He's now in a situation where you have to call the fire department to get him out of the apartment.
I'm not leaving unless there's food.
Where's my oxygen? Where's my oxygen?
I'm one.
James grew up close to a chemical plant that made explosives.
This guy's having a hell of a run.
His new mom worked in a shirt factory his dad was a sharecropper.
Okay.
Jim was not having the best time. His cousin, quote, he was in a lot of trouble, a very mixed up boy. He always did things that ordinary people wouldn't. My aunt tried to give him back to Big Brothers because she couldn't handle him, but they wouldn't take him back. So his adopted family tried to return him.
And they were told no.
Yeah, they were like, you fucked that up.
Nope, you took him.
No, you fucked that shit up.
You took the empty beer can.
How long you had this? 4 years? You could totally fuck this up. We're not taking this.
Nope.
There's a time limit. Did you check the time limit?
We have the receipt.
Yeah, look at the receipt. This is 1 year.
We want to trade him in for another boy. We like that one over there.
No, you already broke this one.
Come on, we'll take two. One for two.
This isn't Costco.
Ugh. Well, come on, James. Mommy loves you.
When, James was 12, his adopted father died.
Okay.
So it's like this guy's hitting all the points.
Well, not a lot of people get to lose two dads.
Four.
It's very lucky.
The next 5 years, he lived with his adopted mom in a house that had no plumbing or electricity.
There's Fight Club in it.
Oh, Jesus, they are. She remarried in 1964. Now a teenager, Jim pretty much scared the shit out of his mom. So much so that she started sleeping with a gun under her pillow.
Whoa. That's real scared.
This is why you don't abandon your children in Joplin and die on them and try to give them back.
And why you don't adopt.
I don't know why you hate me. I just tried to give you away once. But at school, James got good grades, played trombone in the marching band, and worked on the yearbook. Things were different at home. That's where he would lose it. It is believed that when he was 19, he chased his mother around the house with an axe and was charged with assaulting his stepfather after he broke several of his ribs.
He's got a new dad?
Yeah. Remember I said she got remarried in 64?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, wait.
But wait, he died.
No, that one died. Oh, no, she remarried. Remarried.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So he's trying to kill his third?
His dad died. Yeah, he's trying to kill his third dad.
Dude, come on, have a little respect.
I hate threes. It's a shitty number.
I want my fifth dad.
He was having such a hard time that he tried to kill himself by taking 36 Anacin tablets. He was then committed to a Missouri State mental hospital in 1966 and diagnosed with catatonic schizophrenia.
Okay.
So he's
super.
Yeah, his shit's fucked
he's
up.
He's super.
James was also a smart kid who loved school. He went to the University of Missouri at Kansas City. There he met Leanne Miller, and they were soon married.
Okay.
So he's back on track.
Mm.
He's back on track.
Mm.
But right back on track.
Mm.
The two were social misfits. She was a small and plain and wore glasses. Leanne deferred to Jim. In June 1969, they had a daughter, Tori Ann.
Okay.
Who had Down syndrome.
Okay.
And tons of health issues.
Things are coming together.
But they adored her. The two started working as bookkeepers for Haley's Instant Tax Service. They managed...
We'll do your taxes right now.
They managed the business for 2 years until James lost his shit on the owner. The owner wanted... to bring home a calculator for the night, and James went bug fuck on it.
Oh, God. Jesus. That's amazing.
He liked his calky, man. That's my calky.
Okay.
My calky.
All right. Okay.
My nickname is calky.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay.
You don't sleep with it. You don't sleep with my calculator.
Did you say sleep with it?
You don't. I sleep with my calculator.
Sorry. I don't want the calculator anymore.
It's not a calculator. It's calky.
Oh, God.
So he was fired.
For what? Kidding.
Soon, James and Leanne opened a...
I'm assuming he was fired for going crazy about a calculator.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they opened their own tax service business called Lewis & Lewis.
All right.
When they were there, they met and became friendly with an older man named Ray West. Ray was also a client. Ray was there to comfort them when Tori Ann died from complications after heart surgery on December 10th, 1974.
Oh, boy.
So she was around 5. They loved her. They talked about her all the time. They were completely grief-stricken and would continue to talk about their daughter and show off her drawings to anyone who came in. Now, Ray was a lifelong bachelor who lived with his mother until she died in 1977.
Okay.
Ray was well known around the neighborhood. He helped everybody out. Every Sunday, he brought newspapers to the florist. I guess that's what they, back then they wrapped up
flowers
and newspapers. Yeah. So he'd bring them down.
They still do that with like fish and chips in England.
Would you bring them newspapers or do they just...
They use newspaper. So I'm sure they get them somewhere. Not the most hygienic.
On July 23rd, 1978, he told the florist he was feeling sick and went home.
Ray West.
Yeah.
Okay.
The next day, Ray's friend Charles Banker couldn't get a hold of him and became concerned. He drove over to Ray's house and found all the doors locked and the car in the garage. No one answered the door. The cops came. They called James to see if he knew anything, and James said Ray had gone to the Ozarks for a few days with his girlfriend. Cops thought that sounded good, but it was weird to Charles because Ray had never had a girlfriend.
Okay.
If he was going away, he would tell everyone. So Charles filed a missing persons report. 2 days later, he went back to Ray's house and found a note written on Lewis and Lewis letterhead.
Oh, if I please.
What?
Just, okay, go ahead. But I'm already flagging this as stupid.
Quote, Ray's out of town until Thursday. For further information, call Jim. Charles called the police. This time, the cops forced their way in. Everything seemed fine. They also found a note that said, it was on the living room table. It said, quote, please don't disturb until after 1. Sleeping late. Raymond.
I mean, oh boy. There are so many problems with that idea. Hey, Ray, who are you writing that note for? Hey, you never know. In case people think I'm dead. I'm just sleeping late. I don't know. Doop-da-doop-da-doo.
Charles immediately said that was not Ray's writing, and he never signed things Raymond.
Then the next day, there's going to be a note that's like, I hired somebody to write these for me. Don't ask any more questions about that. Raymond.
Charles then bought new padlocks and locked all the doors. Now, as he was doing this, James drove up to the house, got out of his car, and ran up yelling, what in the hell are you doing?
The right thing.
Charles explained that he was putting on new locks. They spoke briefly, then Lewis left, drove around the corner, and parked behind a delivery truck and watched what was going on. Super not suspicious behavior. Incredibly not suspicious.
So shady.
Nothing suspicious about it. He eventually, the delivery truck drove away, and he just sat there for another 5 minutes.
Oh, gosh. I should move.
Charles did not go back to Ray's house until August 14th.
How long of a gap is that?
Okay, so he went missing on July 23rd.
Okay, so like a month.
So we're 3 weeks in. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
When they arrived, when Charles arrived, he smelled something terrible.
Was there a note? Upstairs farting. Don't come up. Raymond.
He searched the home and noticed there were some slight differences in the bedroom than when he'd been there before. Then he moved a sheet and found dried blood.
Mm.
Now police knew they were looking for a body because of the dried blood and because it smelled like a dead body.
Oh, gosh.
Ray had been gone for 21 days. It's summer.
Ugh.
They found a lawn chair covered in blood in the basement. Ray's toupee and eyeglasses in a garbage bag. They checked the attic because there was a giant blood stain leaning up to it that they had somehow missed before.
What?
And there was Ray. Decomposed with both legs severed at the hip joints and tons of blood. The evidence show he had been pulled up into the attic by a harness with a pulley device.
Oh my God.
But they couldn't figure out the cause of death. No wounds, no trauma.
Wait, they couldn't figure out the cause. It was the leg removal.
No, that happened after he was dead.
Oh, God. What?
But what they did find was a $5,000 check made out to James that had been withdrawn on the day Ray disappeared.
Oh, my God.
He's a fucking...
I forgot the police existed.
Let me tell you something about this guy. He's a fucking shrewd planner.
Good. Smart. Smart.
Does not leave any tracks.
Smart. Hello, the name's Red. Red Herring.
James was arrested. He made excuses for everything and gave fingerprints and a handwriting sample. James said he did not have Ray's checkbook, and then police searched his car where they found his checkbook.
Seems pretty open and shut here, David.
Along with 20 feet of knotted white rope, which is
pulleying rope.
Weirdly, knotted white rope was what was used on the pulley.
Weird.
And a black attaché case with papers bearing West's name.
Interesting. And a note that said, I murdered him.
Oh, no, James said he did not kill Ray.
Oh, really? Really? Okay.
Didn't do it.
Nope.
Didn't do it.
Nope.
All this stuff is easily explainable.
I'm framing myself.
So he starts with capital murder. But just before the October 1979 trial date, the prosecutor asked for a dismissal of the case. James had a very good defense lawyer. Police had made tons of mistakes arresting James, including not reading him his Miranda warning, which meant all of the evidence gathered...
Inadmissible.
And the coroner still had no cause of death.
Okay.
James' lawyer, quote, "It is one thing to kill somebody. It's another thing to dismember them after they're dead. And while dismembering somebody after they're dead is repulsive and repugnant, it's not homicide. It's my impression that he did not do it.
Wait.
There really is no foul play prior to Ray's death." So the lawyer, James' lawyer, says that he doesn't think he killed them, but that he did.
He get out of here.
Take the body apart after.
Wow. That is. What?
Yeah. I mean, look, he's a good attorney.
The only thing he's guilty of is removing the legs and putting him in the attic. Some other creep killed him. Boy, the judge was probably like, sorry, I'm going to need that one more time.
Four more times.
This is why we hire the stenographer. Bring that to me. I want to read it.
So that was it. The Lewises went back to their accounting business. And
I'm sorry. That was it?
They had to drop the case.
Because not reading his rights.
Yeah, basically they fucked up. And other things like the chain of evidence and all. They fucked up across the board.
I'm going to go get my taxes done by that guy who took the legs off that guy you didn't murder. He's the best.
They renamed their accounting business No Legs Lewis. That'd be the best. Then I would go to them. All right, so they go back to their accounting business, and then they started other businesses. They had a business they'd started with a pharmacist to import industrial pill-making machines that had been manufactured in India. James liked to brag about his international business connections and deals. But everything he was involved in was failing. Kansas City cops thought James was running a credit fraud enterprise. Quote, "He would invent an address, pound a mailbox into the ground, then pull the mailbox out of the ground and move on to the next place." So basically, he's getting credit with a fake address. He's putting a fucking mailbox in some crazy place that looks like there's an address there. Then they deliver the credit card or whatever, and then he pulls the mailbox out and...
I mean, this is next level. He's using the same mailbox?
Yeah, oh, it's fucking the best thing ever. Now I'm on his side.
I mean, look, if you can expose that flaw, I think you're allowed to. Ah, cool, credit card. Well, let's get the mailbox. Get out of here.
He's also swindling clients in a land deal. Police searched his home, found evidence, and issued a warrant. The Lewises then went on the run in their 69 Dodge Rambler.
Okay.
They came up with the aliases Robert and Nancy Richardson and moved into a small apartment in Chicago. Leanne got work as a bookkeeper. James just read books and had highbrow discussions with neighbors.
Sounds like a fun job.
Quote, I thought he was the smartest man I ever spoke to. He always talked about money, not necessarily having some, but he used to go through the financial sections of newspapers all the time and cut small pieces out.
Okay. Always a smart person.
We know this guy. He's the most annoying man on earth.
Yeah. He's the new Dos Equis spokesperson. The most annoying man on earth.
Quote, it was like he went to the Salvation Army and bought his suits. He wanted to look dressed to have a tie and coat on. James always acted like he had somewhere to go, though all he did was walk Leanne to the bus stop and meet her for lunch. Sometimes he'd go to her office to show her a fancy pen he bought. Oh, he was super proud of his handwriting.
Here he is. What? Look at that, huh? You believe how lucky you are? Look at that. Look at that.
Look at that.
That is unbelievable penmanship. Look at that.
Bring your... Everybody gather around. I got to see this O I made.
Who's doing Z's like this? Honestly. Woo! Who's doing cursive Z's high like five. This? High Come five. On. Give me high fives. Huh? Who wants me to write him a letter? $1,000 a letter. Come on. My letters are unbelievable. You see my handwriting? Don't walk by this. Boy, you're going to wish you could read that again. Whoa.
In January 1982, James got a job at Chicago Tax Service, but it didn't go well.
Okay.
The owner found a mistake James had made on a tax form, and James completely lost his shit.
Uh-oh.
He was fired on the spot.
So it's calculator too.
So then he started doing temp work.
Okay. Always fun.
Meanwhile, things were not going well at Leanne's job. The new owner, Fred McCahey, was blowing it. Bank accounts were overdrawn, and airlines had pulled the agency's ticketing privileges. He was using company money to pay his personal bills. Leanne quit in April 1982, but before she did, she stamped a stack of blank envelopes with postage from the business meter. The postmark was April 15th, 1982.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, right?
No.
The next week, the business was shut down. The owner gave everyone final checks. They all bounced, including Leanne's last check. But Leanne and James had cashed her check at a currency exchange. When the currency exchange came asking for the money back, the Lewises became, quote, agitated.
Mm-hmm.
They were very adamant in their position that they didn't owe the money, that they had worked for it, and that McCahey was a crook and he should have to pay.
Okay.
Okay?
He has to pay.
That guy there. James was reading law books, and he got the rest of the employees together and had them file complaints with the Illinois Department of Labor Wage Claim Board.
Okay.
So with a bunch of documents, they went to the August 3rd hearing with all of her coworkers. James was the group spokesman.
Okay.
He wanted the wage claim officer to look at the
Let's owners. Let the schizophrenic lead this.
He wanted the wage claim officer to look at the owner's personal accounts. So he wants him to look at McKay's personal account.
Sure.
But he can't. That's beyond his scope. He can't look at personal accounts.
Okay.
James was then told he couldn't speak because he wasn't even an employee. And then he went and sat in the corner and watched. And then the ruling went against the employees.
Oh, boy. Airtight.
There was no money in the business accounts, and that was the end of it. James and Leanne then got into a screaming match with the owner, McCahey, and the owner threatened Leanne.
Oh, boy.
Around this time, James got a freelance column published in the Chicago Tribune. In July, along with his photograph. It was called A Slice of Chicago Life. It was about people watching for 10 minutes.
He cut off some guy's legs. It was... A Slice of Chicago. The best pizza in town. By a man who removed legs from a body. Admittedly. And probably murdered him.
It was about people watching for 10 minutes at State and Madison. It was written in verse.
Okay.
One well-dressed evangelist, bullhorn blasting, promises of salvation, A one-legged man walking proud and alone.
That's awkward.
One information booth in the middle of the sidewalk, ignored. One blue and white police car sitting empty, windows open.
How far are you getting into this before you're like, I'm never reading another word?
Jesus Christ, this guy's amazing. Meanwhile, James and Leanne paid only $50 to the currency exchange and then fled Chicago on September 3rd.
Okay. For new names.
On September 4th, using the names Karen and William Wagner.
There we go, the Wagners. The Lewises, the Richardsons, the Wagners.
They bought one-way train tickets to New York City, where they checked into a shitty fleabag hotel in Manhattan, again as Robert and Nancy Richardson.
Sure.
$95 per week rent.
Okay.
Leanne found temp work as Nancy Richardson at a real estate firm called Abrams, Benish, and Riker. Now, back in the suburbs of Chicago, on September 29th, now this is quite some time. This is about a month later, I think, after he left.
Okay. This is in Chicago.
Yeah. 12-year-old Mary Kellerman woke up with a sore throat. She took extra strength Tylenol, then collapsed and died. Adam Janis, 27, had a cold and called in sick to work. He took two extra strength Tylenol and fell into a coma at 11:54 a.m. Mary Reiner, 27, just had her fourth baby. She bought some Tylenol.
Oh, boy.
Took it and was soon in a coma. A 31-year-old woman was at work when she said she was going to the back office to take some pain medicine. She did, collapsed. All these people were soon dead. The confused family of Adam Janis got together that evening at 5 p.m. to talk about funeral arrangements. His younger brother had a headache and asked his wife to get him some extra strength Tylenol. He took two, and so did she, a few minutes later. He dropped in the living room. As the paramedics took him out, she collapsed. They both died. The house was quarantined.
Wow.
Two firemen from different stations were on the phone talking about their day when they realized the similarities in the cases. They both then looked at their incident reports, and the only thing in common was Tylenol. The police were called. The Tylenol from the first girl's home was found in a police station drawer. A nurse had already grabbed the Tylenol from the home where the three Janis family members had died, as she thought it was suspicious they had all taken the Tylenol. A doctor got a poison specialist on the phone who told them to open and smell the bottles. They smelled like bitter almonds. That's what cyanide smells like.
Oh, dude.
What?
I kind of remember this. What year is this?
82.
Yeah.
Flight attendant Paula Prince came back from a Vegas flight that night, bought extra strength Tylenol at the store, then went home and was murdered by poisoning. She would not be found for 2 days. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agents were mobilized. This was the first case of deadly random large-scale product tampering. The Illinois Attorney General, Tyrone Fawner, was the main spokesman. He held press briefings twice a day, which is great for him because he was running behind in his election. Quote, I was on TV every night. People who didn't know who I was all of a sudden did.
Here we go.
What?
What? What? Don't you what me. You know you just threw a landmine and told me to step.
There were hundreds of people working on the case, and it was very confusing. Now remember, this is before computers.
Yeah.
Could you imagine a case like this if you're a cop or FBI? Everybody's coming in.
Yeah.
There's no way to fucking really communicate.
Yeah.
Some law enforcement started withholding information so they could be the one to solve the case. Always good.
Mm-hmm. Always. That's your heart's in the right place.
There was, as hacky as it sounds, a difficult relationship between the FBI and the local cops.
Well, Dave, I mean, I think we can all see how that plays out. The local cops are there. The feds come in. They shut them down. The small town sheriff all of a sudden has a vendetta. He's going to be the hero in the end. It's these feds. They just can't get their heads out of their own asses. It's a small town guy, heart of gold. He's going to prove them wrong. And perhaps get offered to be an FBI agent at the end of all this and say, you know what? No, I'm happy here.
Officials focused on getting Tylenol off store shelves and recalling bottles. Mayor Jane Byrne called for the removal of all Tylenol products from Chicago during a press conference. This started a global panic about Tylenol.
Tylenol headquarters like, good.
How's that what?
Good.
What?
Glad he didn't go with vitamin C.
What's happening? Tylenol's makers, Johnson & Johnson, really didn't want to do a recall.
Just sniff them. Is it so hard to just ask you guys to sniff them before you take them?
If they smell like nuts, they're not, it's not Tylenol.
Guys, look, all we're saying is if it smells like almonds, you will be poisoned by that bottle.
But if not, you get rid of a headache.
Take them.
Finally, the company came to pressure and offered a $100,000 reward for info on the killings. The company then set up labs and began a long process of testing capsules for contamination. Investigators looked into if it had been done by done to manipulate Johnson & Johnson's stock. They looked into the Puerto Rican terrorist group FALN.
Mm-hmm.
Disgruntled employees everywhere on the drug chain were investigated.
Advil.
The Advilers.
The Advilers.
Shoplifters from stores where the Tylenol were purchased were investigated. Cars that had been ticketed nearby were checked out. Family members and friends of victims were looked into.
Now, so where are all the, they're all coming from a one source?
They don't know.
They don't know. They just know now.
They have the lot numbers of the poison capsules.
How widespread is this? This is just
only in mostly Chicago.
Okay, right. Okay.
After the first week, they were getting nowhere. They really thought some evidence would come, but nothing.
They must have had headaches.
Everyone had a headache, but no one wanted to take aspirin. None of the
By the way, how hard is it to put cyanide on almonds?
We
come on, it's a no-brainer. You're going to be fine.
But trust me, I was alive. None of us took any pain pills for a while.
Yeah, right. And that was the only thing on market was Tylenol.
I don't think there was really...
There wasn't like
Bear, I think, was around.
Yeah, but everyone's like, screw you, Bear. We'd rather have headaches.
No. I love a medicine created by the Nazi Party.
I'm sorry?
So, Bear made a lot of money off the whole German...
You know what, Dave? Is there anything on Earth that isn't totally fucked?
So after the first week, the investigation is getting nowhere. They really thought some evidence would come, but it wasn't coming. None of the boxes, bottles, or capsules had usable fingerprints. The working theory was that the murderer had gone to each store, bought the pills,
mm-hmm.
then emptied out capsules, and then filled them with cyanide.
Oh,
then
God.
Return the box to the store shelf, gluing it.
So these are like gel caps.
Right.
Openable caps.
Yeah.
Wow. So they're just cyanide. I thought maybe like the actual aspirin just had like cyanide on it.
No, he's filling capsules up with cyanide.
So that's why. That explains dropping dead immediately.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The media were being pushed by their bosses to get answers that the police did not have.
Good. Always good.
Meanwhile, in New York City, James is watching the news.
Almost forgot about little Jimmy.
He's watching the news and coming up with a plan.
Okay.
To ruin Leanne's boss, Fred McKay.
Oh, boy.
He had been planning this all along. And wow. The Tylenol murders gave him the opening he needed. Now, I remember when Leanne left her job, she took stamped, metered envelopes.
Right.
And because of the investigation into McKay's finances, Lewis had his bank account numbers. So James Lewis wrote a letter and put it into one of those envelopes and mailed it to Johnson & Johnson.
Oh, the God.
Of Tylenol.
Oh, God. What? He wrote a confession letter?
Nope. October 6, 1982, the letter arrived. Johnson & Johnson, parent of McNeil Laboratories. Gentlemen, already really assuming.
Yeah.
I guess there were no ladies.
Sexist work environment.
Gentlemen, as you can see, it is easy to place cyanide, both potassium and sodium, into capsules sitting on store shelves. And since the cyanide is inside the gelatin, it is easy to get buyers to swallow the bitter pill. Another beauty is that cyanide operates quickly. It takes so very little, and there will be no more time to take countermeasures. If you don't mind the publicity of these little capsules, then do nothing. So far, I've spent less than $50, and it takes me less than 10 minutes per bottle. If you want to stop the killing, then wire $1 million to bank account number 8949597 at the Continental Illinois Bank, Chicago, Illinois. Don't attempt to involve the FBI or local Chicago authorities with this letter. A couple of phone calls by me will undo anything you can possibly do. So, of course, that's McKay's bank account.
You know, he's just, you'd think he would learn a little more in the framing game.
What, this is foolproof. This is foolproof.
How did you find me? You put your bank account number on there. That's the scenario in his head.
Use your own envelope.
Yeah, use your own envelope and told us your bank account number. Besides that, someone squeal.
So he knew.
So
he knew the envelope and the bank account would lead him to McKay, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean.
But his assumption was that the FBI would investigate him and quickly rule him out for the killings. But during that investigation, they would uncover all of his white-collar crimes.
Okay.
Which basically is just going bankrupt.
Right. Okay. So
within hours, something happened that he didn't plan on, and that was that the FBI had fingerprints from the letter.
Oh, boy.
Law enforcement did indeed grill McKay, but it didn't add up. They then asked McKay if anyone held a grudge against him.
Yeah. Mr. Lewis Robertson Wagner.
Sure, Jim and Nancy Richardson, he said. Agents found some of Jim's old correspondence from a previous job, and the writing was easily matched with the note.
Well, I mean, he's the kind of guy who'd be like, I can't lie, those beautiful letters are mine. You've caught me.
Do you want to see the pen that I wrote it with?
I'm guilty of having addictive handwriting.
So the FBI went public with the letter on October 7th. James then told Leanne that evening what he had done. She didn't understand.
How was your day? Good.
Well,
Oh, I got those nectarines you like.
I did something impulsive.
Okay.
With the envelopes that I plan on using.
Oh, I thought we agreed we'd talk about those before we use it. What did you do?
I sort of tried to frame McKay for that Chicago thing where all those people died. And no one's paying attention, I don't think.
Oh, I thought you did something crazy.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good plan. It's solid.
You want to make sure you have one that's not too firm, nectarine-wise.
When he turned her, she just turned around and stared at the wall.
Oh. Words? Please? Honey? Oh, boy. You know how to make me feel bad.
A week later, a warrant was issued, and a picture of James was published. Kansas City cops looked at the photo and called Chicago. They said there was actually a guy named James Lewis who was suspected of murdering Ray West.
I just took his legs!
Enough with that! Can't a guy take off a guy's legs after he's dead?
Come on!
Not a crime where I'm from.
It's not murder.
Up until now, law enforcement thought James was just pulling off a hoax to get money. Now they thought he was the Tylenol murderer.
Oh, boy. Jeez, he's really messed up.
Though there was another suspect. Dock worker Roger Arnold. Roger liked to get drunk and talk. One night, he was talking about the Tylenol murders, and someone took note and snitched on him. He was arrested on an old warrant. There were coincidences. He worked at a warehouse with the father of one of the victims. His wife was in a psychiatric ward of a hospital across from the store where the bottle of Tylenol had been bought. And he was a closet chemist.
Okay.
The FBI searched his home and found a bag of chemical powder, beakers, and funnels. But the powder turned out to be potassium carbonate, not cyanide. Arnold yelled at reporters, quote, I'm not saying what the chemicals were used for, but it was nothing illegal. Just leave my potassium carbonate alone.
Come on. Quit treating me like a weirdo.
Can a fellow like potassium carbonate?
I'm just a guy with beakers of potassium.
He was charged with assault and weapons violations and then released on bond. He was very, very angry. Then the law turned all their attention back to James Lewis. He wasn't working in New York, but things were about to get difficult for him. By mid-October 1982, photographs of the Lewises were on television screens and front pages nationwide.
Oh, boy.
On October 14th, one of the owners of the hotel they lived in saw a bearded James in the lobby. He felt like he knew James from somewhere and asked, quote, do I know you from someplace? Do you live maybe in another building of mine, 94th Street, 84th, 99th, 17th Street? James said he was from Missouri. It wouldn't be until later the owner would remember where he knew James from. Leanne didn't return to her temp job the next day. Once again, the couple made a run for it. On October 18th, a worker from Leanne's temp job called the New York City Police Department. Cops and FBI agents flooded Manhattan for days searching block by block, but they could not find the Lewises, who are now staying in transient hotels. On October 18th, they checked into a roach-infested shared bathroom hotel. The media was all over the James angle, talking to his friends and anyone who had ever met him, and they all gave differing opinions. Quote, he could talk to you on any subject and convince you, no matter how much you knew, he knew more. What a dick.
Yeah.
Just, that's why, it's weird that that's why I hate him the most.
Yeah. Yeah, a know-it-all.
And another quote, he seemed to have a good heart. He'll be getting a kick out of his life reading about himself, and he'll be five steps ahead of everybody. He's that smart. Sound like that guy.
Nope. Oh. Next.
Others saw a bad guy. The man who gave Lewis his first job in Kansas City said, quote, he has the most bizarre personality I've ever met in my life, and I've met thousands.
Okay, I like it.
Another quote, he'd glare, he'd stare at you and not say anything.
Interesting.
One woman said after a minor disagreement, James refused to talk to her for 3 months.
Hopefully you put that time on it right then. 3 months, no!
Okay, it's up. So, how are you?
I'm good. You're crazy.
3 months!
No, no! Shit!
10-year acquaintance said, quote, he has ice in his veins.
Okay.
So obviously, James's plan to get McKay is not going well.
Terribly. He's confessed to killing people now.
The FBI clearly didn't give a shit about Fred McKay. James has made himself the target. So, he sent a death threat to President Ronald Reagan.
Oh, that's always the right direction.
Hoping to lead authorities to Fred McKay.
Wait, he's still... Fred McKay's like, I wish he didn't take those envelopes. Really?
If I can give anybody advice, it's lock up the envelopes.
Dear Mr. Reagan, I'm going to kill you.
See front of envelope.
Really check this envelope out.
In the letter to Reagan, he demanded changes in federal tax policy or the Tylenol killings would continue and the White House would be attacked with
headaches.
Remote-controlled modeled airplanes that would jam Secret Service radio transmissions. I mean,
he's droning them.
It's so fucking complicated.
Yeah.
It's so complicated.
Yeah.
And then there's got to be a lot of airplanes, tiny ones, little tiny airplanes, and you guys won't be able to talk to each other.
The second when you say, like, tiny airplanes, you're like, throw this out. It just says tiny airplanes.
But nothing happened. So he started writing to newspaper editors. He sent the Chicago Tribune.
Just in using these envelopes, trying to frame McKay.
A bunch of documents about the McKay payroll situation.
Jeez.
With a note.
Oh, no.
Why isn't anybody getting this? They're not getting it. The real criminal.
God.
This is over $500. That's how much the paycheck was. $511.
He wrote a letter to the president saying he was going to kill him for $500.
And $11. Of which he got everything except for $50.
Yeah. Yeah.
He got it all.
Yeah. It's just that he, wait a minute. Yeah, because he screwed them over at a check cashing place. So what is he mad about? What is he doing?
This guy fucked up my credit report.
I mean, and now the overcorrection that's going on. Jesus. Like, this is like a stain that you just keep cleaning with the wrong product. And you're like, oh, God. Okay, now I think we might just need to embrace a purple carpet at this point.
Honey, all I did was threaten the president this time.
God,
that's it.
Give me all of your envelopes.
Oh, my God. You are such a minx. I love you. But let's just wrap it up. I gotta write to the Chicago Tribune.
All right, I'm gonna write one to Nancy Reagan and then I'll come to bed.
So he writes to the Tribune, quote, as you have probably guessed, my wife and I have not committed the Chicago area Tylenol murders.
Dude.
We do not go around killing people. We never have, and we never shall. Contrary to reports, we are not armed, unless one means in the anatomical paraplegic sense. Waka waka. Pew, pew.
Hey, by the way, if you confess to removing a guy's legs, you don't get to make paraplegic
right?
jokes.
That, you know that's why he did it, though. You know that's why he did it.
Some of my best friends are paraplegics. I can razz them.
We shall never carry weapons, no matter how bizarre, the FBI and police reports. Domestically, weapons are for two quite similar types of mentalities.
You know
one,
what?
One, criminals. Two, the police. We are neither. Signed, Robert Richardson.
I hate him, too. I think this, it's like just,
that's it?
Well, I mean, obviously he's very hateable already, but that is just, it's a very annoying letter.
No, he's a dick.
He's making jokes and he's giving a list. Those are two red flags.
In November, he sent the Kansas City Star a 7-page letter titled A Moral Dilemma. Quote, I grew up as a Southern Missouri hillbilly. Then life was relatively simple. Values of right and wrong were clear-cut, black and white. The law was to be obeyed. The sheriff was to be obeyed and respected, and on and on. He just went on and on about his whole fucking life story.
Okay.
Blah, 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 blah. He also taunted Kansas City authorities to reopen the Ray West murder case.
Okay.
Which they did.
Why would he do that? What is he doing? Why? What? Like, is this a game show?
He's out of his fucking mind.
He must know something that no one else knows. There must, like, a Martian must have come to him and been like, confess in the craziest ways possible.
Kansas City police sent representatives to Chicago with boxes of evidence, and the FBI found something. One latent print off the rope and pulley in the attic. It was ID'd as the right thumb of one James William Lewis.
I thought it was going to be that Wagner guy.
During the week of Thanksgiving, James sent another letter explaining he had made the extortion attempt to shine the light on the real criminal, Fred McKayhee.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's just coming out with it. Look! Since you're not getting it, I have to hit you over the fucking head!
Fred McKayhee's like, please, James, stop. I'll give you the $50.
It is, quote, it is my hope that by sending the...
Fred McKayhee murdered me! Why aren't you saying this?
Stop talking about Tylenol!
Okay? I didn't do the Tylenol. I did take that guy's legs.
This is the real ding. The real ding is that he owes me $500. Well, not me, but personally. He fucked up my credit. That's worse.
You guys have an unhealthy obsession with one man, me, that you're just not going to let it go until you have your way. Very different from what I'm doing to Mr. McKayhee. Very different.
It is my hope that by sending the information to the press, those powers which have prevented an investigation will acquiesce so that the matter can be properly examined. I have attempted to act as an informant, to act on the side of the law, but the FBI and their state associations have used their precious resources to terrorize, humiliate, ridicule, and speculate in public about the private lives of my family.
Dude,
and me.
No.
Is this what a person who attempts to be a good citizen should expect from the United States Department of Justice?
Pal, I mean, good Lord.
He's trying to point out there's a criminal out there.
James versus reality.
With this letter, he signed his real name.
Whoops.
And he put his right thumbprint on the letter. I mean,
why? So he just...
He's fucking so... At the same time as being... he's like taunting them at the same time.
Right.
But James and Leanne still weren't running. They had just moved a few blocks away in New York. James said they were out on the streets every day, not taking precautions, not hiding. The day before, which I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
If he's so visible on
yeah.
magazines and newspapers and shit. The day before Thanksgiving, Leanne signed for a $140 money order from her father at a Western Union office. They were seen on video, but still the FBI could not find them. Leanne got a job as a bookkeeper under the name Carol Scott.
Okay.
The FBI put out word everywhere. Everywhere that James could get his hands on a Kansas City or Chicago newspaper, right? So they know he's reading these newspapers because it's clear he's communicating. So then now they're like, okay, he's got to be
right
at a place where he gets these newspapers. Smart. And then on December 13th,
1982, a New York Public Library librarian called and said she had just handed a paper to James Lewis. The FBI rushed down and arrested him. James pleaded not guilty at his extortion arrangement, but they still couldn't connect him to the Tylenol murders. They couldn't connect anyone. The task force was cut down by 80% in January. Tylenol returned to store shelves. They were now, as we have
come... Now without cyanide.
This is a little cyanide-free, yeah. Like they've come up with a little cartoon character. Yeah. Cyanide-free!
Yeah. Sammy Cyanide says, nope, nope. No!
Okay, so now Tylenol was as we know it today, tamper-resistant. The drug company had lost... So before this, it's literally just a box and inside is the bottle, and uh-huh. You just pop it open,
and that was
and there's that's it.
Right.
Now they've got a seal. They've got the
so
cotton.
The cotton. The cotton is from this.
Cotton was originally used for prescriptions that had like maybe a temperature situation uh-huh. or couldn't be moved around a lot. So cotton was put in there for a specific purpose.
And
but
now.
It was never with Tylenol or aspirin. So now you've got.
So he's the reason.
So now you've got the cotton. You've got the resistant top, uh-huh. right? That you have to puncture to get
sealed.
In there. That's all because of this.
Wow.
Not him, but the Tylenol.
But the guy, whoever it is, or the person.
The company, Johnson & Johnson, had lost $100 million, and new regulations were now instituted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Before 1982, right, only moisture and temperature-sensitive medications had protective seals. Now they all did. Leanne would not speak to investigators. She was charged with misappropriating the Social Security number she used to become Nancy Richardson. She was offered a deal, but never spoke.
Wow.
Computer.
She just looked at the wall.
Yeah.
Nancy?
This
is a Poltergeist vibe.
I'm disappointed.
Oh, boy. She's singing the disappointed song again.
Computer consultant John Stanisha was leaving a Lincoln Avenue bar on the morning of June 18th, 1983. Stanisha looked like the bartender previously accused and still angry Roger Arnold thought had snitched on him.
He's the bar... He's... Okay, right. Gotcha.
Remember the guy?
Yep, the loose lips guy.
So
who,
he thinks this is who snitched on
okay,
him.
Okay, right.
Arnold walked up to Stanisha, yelled, "You turn me in," and shot him in the head, killing him.
You think I'm capable of killing people?
Now you know. I am not.
Oh, wait. No.
Take back...
Wait. Oh, no.
Arnold would be tried and convicted and sentenced to 30 years in prison.
Wow, that's kind of light.
After a six-day trial, James Lewis was found guilty of attempted extortion on October 27, 1983.
He was extorting himself.
He was 37. In prison, James offered to be of a... Okay, first of all, no one would eat his pastries in the...
Wait, whoa, excuse me?
None of the other prisoners... He worked in the kitchen, and they refused to eat his pastries.
Oh, because they were like, he's going to make cyanide empanadas.
I think that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
They also gave him the nickname Tylenol Man.
Oh, man, that is...
Hey, Tylenol Man, don't want to eat your pastries.
My name is James.
Okay, McKay. Okay, TM.
Don't
Tylenol Man.
I'm
what's
not the
going
Tylenol.
On?
I didn't have anything to do with it.
Hey.
I wrote it in an envelope.
Hey, Tylenol Man.
I'm not Tylenol Man. I just took a man's legs once.
Ha!
You know what? Stick to Tylenol, man.
Okay, so he's in prison, and there... So he hasn't been sentenced yet, but he's in prison having been convicted, right? He's in that time period. So he offers to be of assistance to the Tylenol Task Force.
You know what? I think we should team up.
You know what? I'm clearly a mastermind of some kind.
Look... You guys are deep in this. I'm deep in this. Let's pool our resources and come to the conclusion that it was probably McKay. Come on. If they said yes to that. We have three zones here where we're looking for the guy. Yeah. Also, I think we should probably reopen the McKay part. I mean, that guy is just such a dickhead. You know he owes me $50.
He called assistant U.S. attorney Jeremy Margolis, who had helped put him in jail. Margolis and James met several times in Margolis's office discussing and theorizing on the murders for hours and hours.
Why is he allowing that? So James is actually maybe making... Go ahead.
James came with, quote, probably hundreds of pages of manuscripts, diagrams, and theories as to how these killings might have happened.
Is he humoring him, or is he like actually like, yeah, you got a point there, James.
The cops, despite the problems with the theory, have decided that he did it.
Oh, they think that James did it.
A bunch of them did.
Okay. And he did not.
Fuck no.
Yeah, right. He did the worst framing job possible.
Could this moron pull off the Tylenol murders?
No.
He's a fucking moron.
What he could do is pull off implicating himself in the Tylenol murders that he had nothing to do with.
So, in one drawing, James went into great detail about how a breadboard could be used to put poison into capsules. By drilling holes in the board, then placing empty caplet halves into the holes, then filling them with cyanide and scraping off the excess with a knife, recapping the capsules, and then putting them back into the original containers. He said it could be done in a store parking lot. So he's... I don't know why he's... I just think he likes to talk and be heard, but this is actually a smart idea on how to do it. So he is... making it look like he did it by coming up with his ideas that work.
That he's nailing it. Right.
So FBI agents and policemen were there during all the meetings taking notes, hoping Lewis would screw up, but he never did. No.
That's what I did.
I'm talking about the other one. Like the eyeball got me. That your eye in your head.
I'm going to actually shock a lot of people here. McKay, he didn't do this.
James was also not happy about the judge who convicted him or his defense attorney, Michael Monaco. His attorney then stepped down. James filed a motion that the judge should be removed because he had relationships with corrupt Teamsters, affiliations with the same attorney general's office that refused to investigate McKay, and statements to the Federal Bar Association calling prisoners who acted as their own attorney psychopaths.
Okay.
The motion was denied.
Oh, shocking.
James was sentenced to 10 years.
Can you kill McKay? No. Damn it.
James was sentenced to 10 years in prison, where he's obviously called Tylenol Man. In 1987, he filed for a sentence reduction.
Okay.
Quote, this is what he writes. Lewis was convicted not because he committed any crime, but because the U.S. attorney, Daniel Webb, in open court, threatened to kill the jurors with poison and with a gun. The defendant will never forget the fear in the jurors' eyes. Mr. Webb committed the crime of extortion in open court, an act that amounted to jury tampering. No one can blame the poor jurors when they themselves were the victims of such acts of terrorism.
Wait, that's completely bullshit.
It is the craziest thing that he's done so far.
Okay, now he is starting to crack.
I mean, this isn't a great sign.
Yeah, well, you can easily go through the court records and be like, yeah, there's no...
No, I don't see him.
You never said anything about poison. There's nothing about a gun in here.
Nothing about him pointing a gun at the jury.
All right, well, there we go.
You will convict! You will convict!
We don't need to deliberate.
And if you don't, I will shoot you and poison your families. I rest my case.
We're with him. Yep. Guilty.
There we go. No way you can appeal this.
Yep.
So shockingly, his motion was denied. On October 13th, 1995, James Lewis was released from the federal penitentiary at El Reno, Oklahoma, and went straight back to Leanne, who was waiting for him. In 2009, the FBI and the Illinois State Police executed a search warrant of James Lewis's apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nothing was found. In 2010, Lewis and his wife, Leanne, gave DNA samples at the request of investigators. No charges have been brought. It's not known why they conducted the searches. As the warrants and affidavits were impounded by the court, the public cannot examine the court filings. With the Tylenol case being reactivated, no one outside of the case can examine the investigators' records from 82 or 86 or currently. Active investigations are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act.
But
if they're still looking at James Lewis in 2010, it means they do not believe their own long-held story that a lone madman bought the Tylenol, purchased it in stores, and then put cyanide in and replaced it. because he was in New York at the time.
Right.
So they're going against their own long-held
theory,
absolute theory, that that's what happened. In 2011, former Johnson & Johnson employee and whistleblower, I didn't write down his name, but he wrote a book called The Tylenol Mafia. In it, he breaks down mistakes the investigators made. They treated Tylenol coming off the shelves like a recall instead of an investigation. All capsules were shipped to Johnson & Johnson, who destroyed them. Less than 1% of capsules in Chicago were inspected. So that means we actually don't know how many cyanide capsules were out
there. They were all destroyed. Right.
Johnson & Johnson's not going to fucking tell you.
Yeah.
They said they found one. Really? Really? Yeah. So it just happened to be that seven people got them?
Mm-hmm. Yep. What do you think, Johnson? I'm with it. Yeah, for sure. I agree with Johnson.
Investigators immediately targeted people like family members and tried to build the case against them instead of following leads. Any possible DNA evidence was contaminated in 1982 because lab workers used their bare hands.
Oh, God.
They also thought Mary Reiner's capsules had come from a bottle of regular strength Tylenol, but she had actually mixed extra strength Tylenol in with her regular strength. At that time, women got extra strength Tylenol when leaving the maternity ward, which means it was in the hospital change.
Oh, God.
Which means it was not tampered with on a store shelf. It means it was in the supply chain. One lot number of pills, so the lot number that she had on her pills, was originally put on the list and then later removed from lists by authorities.
Why?
Because they didn't want it known that it...
Oh, God.
They never looked at repackaging facilities. So the way this works is acetaminophen powder is made at a plant and then it's shipped in drums and then it's bottled or broken down into other sizable quantities at what's known as a repacking plant.
So wait, so okay, but so within this, like along the, this just so easily is a crime from inside.
Yeah.
Like someone who's making the acetaminophen or someone who's like working in packaging or that's.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So it's broken down at this other place. Early reports stated that no evidence of the packaging had been violated. Which, right. So originally they say in early reports that the Tylenol was not tampered with. And then. That was just...
That doesn't fit the story.
Then it was just gone.
Right.
So Westchester DA Carl Vigari, he believed that. That was what the evidence he was going on. And he spoke out and said, in any criminal investigation, you don't accept the statements of a witness who has interest in Johnson & Johnson. In this case, is certainly not a disinterested party. So he's off the range with all the other cops.
Right.
And... Then the FBI and FDA clamped down saying, quote, sophisticated scientific techniques have revealed that tampering indeed occurred. And then Vigari never spoke about it again.
Okay.
So that being said, this was an entirely new way of people dying, of people getting killed.
Right.
They always look for motive. So this was a whole new way of looking at killings. Chicago police superintendent, it's a terribly insane Polish name, Brzeczek. I mean, who's...
Brzeczki.
Says, quote, this is what he says as of 2012. My opinion is that this was an initial homicide where the bad guy knew the victim, and that was it. And then to cover it up, the bad guy went and contaminated the other ones. This motive makes the most sense to me, but... It doesn't, because now it is clearly maybe our first domestic terrorism thing. 2012, Rick Kappelman, sergeant with the Arlington Heights Police. Without divulging any more than this, the investigation is at this point open and active. They are actively pursuing leads even at this date. Superintendent Berserker. It wasn't James Lewis. James Lewis was an asshole, an opportunist. He tries to extort some money from Johnson & Johnson, and he went to jail. He was in the joint a long time. When someone is in the penitentiary, you can go and talk to him with or without his lawyer present. In all those years, All the work on James Lewis to put it together, nothing.
Wow.
So there's two things I think. I think that number one, it was a new kind of crime that they weren't used to dealing with. I also think they fucked up pretty big with the evidence. And then, but I also think that when you're in the desperate place trying to find anything, and then some fucking nut job comes in, of course they swung to him.
Which happens a lot. I think there a lot, it's like, you know, you're in the business of answering questions, and when you don't have answers, it's not only people get frustrated.
Yeah.
So you need to find something that fits.
And it's a whole nother, like, they didn't understand, like, that some rando could fucking do it for some ridiculous reason.
Yeah.
At a plant. Who's still out there, by the way.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me, like, in that sense of, like, you know, it's so interesting that there are times where there's just a completely new thing that we have to, like, fathom. It's almost like you've a color you never knew existed.
Yeah.
And you're just all of a sudden like, oh, shit, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and it's crazy. I think I just remember hearing about that, but I remember, like...
Well, I remember the fear and how big of a deal it was, but the fucking James Lewis thing is just...
Yeah.
I was just going to write a story about the Tylenol murders.
And then you were like, hello.
And I was like, wait, what the fuck is this?
Hello. Calculator fights.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's always fun to sit around and have a laugh in these interesting times.
Why? What's going on?
Indians lost the World Series.
Are you talking about Chelsea Handler coming back?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, I just want to throw a shout out to Chelsea Handler because she talked about leaving the country, but she said that people need her now and her voice. And I think she's right. And I just want to say thank you, Chelsea.
Boy, I've never seen you this emotional.
Yeah.
This means a lot to you.
There's a crazy level of Hollywood self-importance that I think is delightful. And I think it's really important to know that you, Chelsea Handler, now, in today's world,
it's brave.
You're brave.
It's brave.
Thank you for not moving to Canada.
Yeah. Spain, I think, was the...
Thank you for speaking for those who can't speak, Chelsea Handler.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Boy, how do you feel?
Jesus Christ.
Santa cares.
What'd you say?
Santa cares.